the Gaming Legacy Podcast, where we sit down with the legendary figures and giants of the gaming industry who laid the foundation for what is gaming today. I'm Roger Gross, the editor-at-large for a global gaming business. This is a very special edition of the podcast because we sit down with Art Manteris, the legendary sportsbook operator and author of the new book, The Bookie, which is a review of his tremendous career. He's certainly a special guest, but today we're doing something we haven't done before, which is to do the podcast live and in person with an audience at the Skinny Bar in Boulder City, Nevada, where both Art and I reside. Art is a member of the Sports Betting Hall of Fame for a career that spans some true milestones. He started out at the Stardust in Las Vegas as a young man and later joined the Barbary Coast Sportsbook. He was later hired to run the sportsbook at Caesar's Palace, where he helped to invent and refine prop bets. He was then brought over to the Las Vegas Hilton, where he designed and built the Superbook, the largest sportsbook in the world at that time. Then the Fertitta brothers hired him to run the book's four station casinos in Las Vegas, where he spent the last 20 years of his career. He also played several roles in the legalization of sports betting in the U.S., but he's not completely satisfied with how it rolled out, which we'll talk about today. So let's get right to it and talk to Art Manteris at the Skinny Bar in Boulder City, Nevada. A special thanks to Grant Turner and the staff at the Skinny Bar for helping make this happen, and to our videographer, Billy Walker. Well, welcome to the special podcast. As I said, this is a real special event for me. I've done podcasts for the last 20 years, and this is really one of the few that I've ever done live, and certainly the first one I've ever done in a bar where everybody's drinking. So that's going to be a lot of fun. And Art, why don't you start with giving us a little bit of your background? As we mentioned, you're very reputable when it comes to the sports betting. And how did you get into it? I know you grew up in Pittsburgh.
I did grow up in Pittsburgh, and for better or worse, grew up around sports gambling. So literally have been around it all my life. My uncle was a very well-known handicapper that migrated to Las Vegas eventually. My brother Jimmy, and I think we'll talk about Jimmy a little bit later also, but he worked for Uncle Jack in the beginning and became a bookmaker himself, which wasn't the easiest thing for me in getting through licensing and so forth later. Sure. Later on. But nevertheless, we sold the same product. We were engaged in the same business. And, my cousins and I literally took bets in school, in high school, passed around the old parlay sheets, and envisioned coming to Las Vegas and being bookmakers ourselves, and pursued that a little bit at first. But once I stumbled into the Las Vegas regulated sportsbook industry, that it was game over. There was nothing else that would have interested me, and I knew that I was going to be a lifelong Las Vegas resident pretty early on.
Sure. So sports betting was illegal in Pittsburgh when you were growing up.
Yeah, sure.
How did your uncle get around that?
Well, it was confusing to us as kids because it was so open and transparent. And I tell a story in the book about going to a candy store that our uncle used to take us to from time to time. And we'd love going to the candy store as 10, 12-year-old kids. But it wasn't until several years later that we realized that the back room of the candy store was a bookie operation. but even in our schools, the principal, the teachers would make bets also and talk about them openly in the classroom. So it wasn't something that was really frowned upon. Mm-hmm. And I never looked at it as an illegal vice. I looked at it as a fun business.
Mm-hmm. So when you came to Vegas, you followed your Uncle Jack, and your brother was here too, I believe.
No.
Okay,
no.
You were here first then. No. So why did you decide to come out here?
I was going to the University of Pittsburgh, and not the most serious student in the world. Mm-hmm. My cousins and I and our friends that were living either on campus or around campus at the University of Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon, Robert Morris, Duquesne University, we're all in the same general area. And probably the worst thing I did as a young man was attending bar at the Wooden Keg, the hottest bar on the Pitt campus. And so school wasn't really a priority. And then a movie came to Pittsburgh, and that was very unique at that time, The Fish That Saved Pittsburgh, starring Dr. J, Julius Erving. And in fact, I saw Dr. J today, sitting at the NBA, or yesterday, sitting at the NBA All-Star game with President Obama.
Right.
But filming that movie with Dr. J was so much fun. But it caused another bad semester for me, and that was the end of my run at Pitt. And my parents shipped me out to stay with my sister here in Las Vegas, and finished at UNLV very, very quickly after that.
Okay. So what did you do when you first arrived?
When I first arrived, I was actually intending on pursuing a career as a stuntman. I had a job as a stuntman in this film, and it was a blast. And my scenes were really good. And the director of the movie offered me a job and told me what to do to prepare and invited me to Hollywood. And I intended to pursue that, but I needed to get my degree first.
Right.
So my stop in Las Vegas was just to get my sheepskin, get out of school, and then go on to L.A. But like I said, once I started working in the sportsbook industry, which started at the Fremont Hotel downtown, morphed into the Stardust a year or so later. But once I got into the business, I was done. That was it.
Well, we didn't mention that you were an athlete as well in Pittsburgh. You played some basketball and made a lot of connections there that you use later in life as well.
Yeah, I mostly played baseball, and I did envision having a baseball career as a young man, but that quickly fizzled as I got older. But playing basketball, yeah, was helpful to me and actually helped me get that role in the Fish at Safe Pittsburgh because I was the same size and could play for one of the actors that did not have much talent on the court.
Right.
Good actor, but he couldn't play.
Okay. So when you first got here, sports books were really not part of the casinos. They were kind of standalone operations, mm-hmm. and the casinos didn't really see them as moneymakers. But then you got a job at the Stardust, which at the time was the sports book in the world, basically. All of the lines came out of the Stardust.
They did. It was a big operation. But I followed the Lefty Rosenthal era.
Mm-hmm.
But
right.
His people were still running the Stardust and running the sports book. And it's true that there wasn't many sports books in the hotel casino industry at that time. They were primarily standalone places. Santa Anita Sportsbook, Churchill Downs Sportsbook were probably the two most well known at that time. But I can't go through that era without mentioning Senator Howard Cannon, Senator from Nevada, who successfully lobbied for the reduction of the federal excise tax on sports gambling.
Right.
And the excise tax went from 2%. It actually had been 10% at one time, then went to 2%. And Howard Cannon was instrumental and successful in changing that to a quarter of 1%. Mm-hmm. And that's when the hotels started getting into the business.
Okay, great. So I remember the famous book that Bob Stupak, the guy who invented the stratosphere, he made the 83 Super Bowl. I mean, he middled it and explained what middled mean.
yeah, and he's not another Pittsburgh guy, and he was a big gambler.
And
in fact, he had talked to me a few times as a young man to come and join him and build a sports book.
Right.
Didn't work out. It wasn't the right move for me. But he was a legitimate gambler and a legitimate showman and. I had had some visions that came to fruition.
Yeah, no question. So the Stardust, I know.
Excuse me one second, Roger. And by the way, his father was a bookie in Pittsburgh.
Okay. There you go. The Pittsburgh connection, right?
Yeah.
So the Stardust was an incredible place. It had a bank of telephones outside the sports book were the highest grossing telephones in the world at that time, way before cell phones or faxes or anything. And as soon as the lines were posted, the sports book runners would run to the telephones, right?
That's right. And that reminds me of another Jimmy story. In fact, I tell it in the book about how he was the first man in the country, to my knowledge, that carried a purse. And he literally carried a black leather purse filled with quarters, and the reason being, of course, pay phones were great in those days if you didn't want your phones tapped.
Right, exactly, right. So then you went on to the Barbary Coast, which is now what? The
Cromwell.
The Cromwell, and then it's going to be the Vanderpump or something like that. I lost track a long time ago, but that was a place where you really, really learned a lot because there were that wasn't a main sports book, but it was still a pretty big one. Tell the story about when your bosses left you alone on a big fight night. I mean, that was always funny to me.
Well, I did learn a lot at the Stardust, and unfortunately, not all of it was good things to know. But it did help me in my career because I realized some of the things that were going on behind the scenes.
Right.
And I needed to get out of there at that time. And fortunately, my uncle introduced me to Michael Gaughan, mm-hmm. Who was great and a great guy to work for. And that's and my boss when I went to the Barbary Coast was Jimmy Vaccaro, who was a lifelong friend.
Sure. Yep.
He and Sonny. So
another legend in the sports book industry.
Yeah, sure was. And I have some great stories about Jimmy in the book as well. The night that you're talking about was the night of the Leonard Hearns fight.
Right.
Their first fight. And that was my first day on the job at the Barbary Coast. And when I went in, Jimmy, Uncle Jack, Michael Gaughan, Frank Todi, and the rest of the management team left me there to run the book by myself, day one. And I did it. I asked them the next day. I asked Jimmy Vaccaro. I said, Jimmy, how could you leave me here by myself on that? And he said, Kid, I knew you were going to sink or swim. And he was right. I did, and I swam.
Well, you had massive lines, right, coming trying to place bets.
Yeah.
That was before the days of kiosks.
And it was when things were still handwritten.
Yeah. Right.
And again, that was the best education that anybody could get in the business mm-hmm. because you not only had to write the bets accurately, you had to grade them and parlays and teasers. And horse side, quinellas, and exactas. Grading those things manually and paying them on the fly was pretty complicated. Not too many people could do that today, I can assure you.
Well, Michael Gaughan is another legend in the business, born of a legend. His father was Jackie Gaughan, who opened El Cortez downtown, and Michael ran the Barbary Coast until he opened South Point, and he's still running South Point.
Still running South Point. Michael, if he was here today, he would tell you that once you're my guy, you're always my guy, and he says that to me when I see him sometimes, and I appreciate that so much because... and he was a great, great boss to work for, and he was so helpful to me and my family at different times in our lives when we needed help.
And your cousin is still running the sports book at South Point.
He is, and does a great job. Chris Andrews, we're talking about, mm-hmm. great bookmaker, very successful. And Michael and Frank are still the guys in charge of the property. One time there was a day when I used to take my staff. We would have what was called a party bus, and there'd be 18 or 20 of us that we would go out to lunch and then. Do something educational and entertaining for the management team of my operations. And we started downtown, ate lunch downtown, and then started up the strip visiting every sports book along the way. And, you're looking at screens and televisions and carpet and scratch sheets and everything else, just taking notes on what everybody else was doing. And finally, at the end of the day, we come to the South Point, and I tell everybody, now I'm going to take you where all the customers are. And sure enough, the place was packed.
Sure, right, yeah. And they still have the dollar hot dog right there.
I think it's $1.25 now.
Okay, they raised the price.
Yeah.
So then you went on to Caesar's Palace. I mean, talk about a legendary casino in those days. That was the casino on the Las Vegas Strip. What made you go over there?
I was getting antsy at the Barbary. I wanted to be a manager or at least a supervisor, and so I was looking at every sports book, putting in applications and resumes. And Michael actually put in a good word for me at Caesar, recommended me to the legendary casino manager, Moki Facento, Al Facento Sr., who was a great guy and a great casino operator and another person that I was so privileged to work for. And Moki and I hit it off right off the bat, and he hired me quickly and brought me into Caesars. And, I was only at Caesars that time around for 2 years.
Yeah.
But it was the greatest education and very rewarding. But my life changed dramatically in those 2 years. Yeah. I went from a happy-go-lucky kid to a serious businessman during those 2 years.
Well, they were definitely serious at Caesars. I worked for Caesars early on in Atlantic City as a dealer there, and they didn't fool around at Caesars.
No. It was the greatest education from all vantage points. And I, you know, again, was so blessed to have had that opportunity. I worked for Moki Facento at Caesars and Jimmy Newman at Hilton. Mm-hmm. Seriously, the two best casino operators in the history of Las Vegas, to my knowledge.
No question.
And Frank Todi's right in that category also.
Right. Okay. So while you were at Caesars, you had a role in inventing the pop bets. Tell us about that and William Refrigerator Perry.
Yeah, it's a funny story, but it wasn't so funny at the time. We were booking the Super Bowl in 1985 between the Patriots and the Chicago Bears. The Bears were a very dominant team, had the greatest defense people had seen in a long time, at least since the mid-70s with the Steeler defenses. And two of my staff members came to me, Jimmy Mastriani and Chucky Esposito, came to me and said, why don't we put up a prop on the fridge to score a touchdown in the Super Bowl? And I thought about it. I said, yeah, I might get a little ink. Let's try it. We put it up. We got killed on the prop financially. All the money was on the fridge to score, and we lost a lot of money. We lost $250,000 on that prop alone, which at that time for a standalone property was a lot of money. And it got so much media attention, so much PR, that it was flabbergasting. And the next day, we won the game. We beat the game a little bit, but we lost it all back on that prop. And the next day, Henry Gluck, the chairman of Caesars World, who I spoke to once in my life, and this would be it, calls me. And my secretary comes to get me, says, you have a call from Caesars World waiting in your office. And I said, oh, no, this is going to be the end. And I go back, and Mr. Gluck congratulates me and says, well done, young man. And I said, Mr. Gluck, you know we did not do well on that prop. And he said, kid, we could not buy the kind of publicity that you generated for Caesar's Palace. And he thanked me, congratulated me, and hung up, and I was flabbergasted. But I did walk away knowing the power of sports marketing.
Yeah.
And so it was a lesson well learned.
Sure.
And, yeah, the props, that wasn't the first prop ever offered, but it was the biggest.
Yeah.
And it was very impactful, and it did change the industry, and that's such a big part of the industry now.
Sure. Well, we've just seen the Super Bowl in the last couple of weeks here, and boy, what how many prop bets did they have? Thousands of prop bets, right? I mean.
Yeah. It's now they take more money on the props than they do on the game itself.
Yeah, no question about that, for sure. Yeah. So then you went to the Las Vegas Hilton. What made you go over there?
Well, for what it's worth, you know, as bad as that prop was, it did get the attention of the industry, including the executives at the Las Vegas Hilton.
Right.
John Stremp, Dennis Gomes, Mr. Hilton all took notice and invited me over to talk about building their big project, the Superbook. And, you know, I was very flattered. I was very, very happy at Caesars. I really wasn't looking to leave.
Right.
But I knew what the Hilton was building. And once I got to know the senior management team, I was all in. And they hired me right away, and I went over right away. And you know, they had a shell built at the time that I went there in mid-1986, and by December 1986, we had filled in all the gaps, built the book out, brought in a lot of new technology, especially into the display side, and we were off and running. And the project was very, very well received by the local community, the international press, the gaming press. It was a home run.
Yeah, well, it's...
And by the way, What was very noticeable, Hilton went from no sports book to the biggest and best sports book overnight when they opened. And lo and behold, hotel occupancy, hotel revenue, food and beverage, slot drop, casino revenue,
right.
Everything increased dramatically
after
the opening of the sports book.
Well, it was the largest sports book of its kind at the time in the world, so it was an amazing project. So, well, let's talk about some of those three people you mentioned. Baron Hilton, was a really prescient hotel guy, but he understood the gaming industry too.
Oh, he sure did. Sure did. And Mr. Hilton was very, very instrumental in developing casino surveillance systems.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of people don't realize that, but he was a groundbreaker in that area. There's reasons for it, because he had there were some problems in the casino just before I joined the company. But, he was very innovative and demanded the best quality surveillance techniques in gaming.
Yeah.
And that also was an extremely valuable lesson for me.
Yeah, I was lucky to have been able to interview him at the time. But then you also mentioned Dennis Gomes. Dennis was one of my mentors, for sure. He helped me expand our publication empire, so to speak. But Dennis was a real legendary visionary in the business.
Yeah, sure was. And John, his
John
number two guy,
was
just brilliant. And as I was mentioning earlier this evening, just was so helpful to me.
Sure.
I never could have achieved the kind of success that I achieved in my field if I hadn't worked for John.
Yeah, he was a real numbers guy. He knew the numbers.
He was tough, and he was intelligent, but brilliant. And the questions that he would ask, really, you had to figure them out.
Sure,
you know,
you couldn't
blow them off. That's for sure.
Right.
But it was the best education imaginable.
For sure. And he later went on to become the CFO for Wynn Resorts and was one of Steve Wynn's right hand man. So
and that was no surprise to me.
Yeah. Yeah, no question. So then the last stop of your storied career was at Station Casinos, and you were lured over there, I guess, by the Fertitta brothers.
I was, and I had talked to them off and on for a number of years, but it wasn't cost-effective for them to reach out to me at that time, and it wasn't something I was interested in
right.
at that time. And then eventually there was a group from L.A. that bought the Las Vegas Hilton, Ed Roski, who now owns the Silverton Hotel and Casino. And that deal fell through, but Mr. Roski came to me. I was the first person at the property after the sale was announced. I was the first person, actually, through local attorney Bob Fess, who was representing Mr. Roski.
Another one of my mentors, by the way.
Yeah, great guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bob and Mr. Roski called me and talked to me, and I said I would consider it if I can build the executive team. I want to work with you directly to build the presidency, the CFO, the marketing director, and so forth for the property. And he promised me that I could do that. And so, it interested me very much. I agreed to join him. But then the deal fell through.
Yeah.
For a lot of reasons. The deal fell out at the last minute. And so now I felt very uncomfortable, you know, staying with Hilton, which was then had become Park Place Entertainment under Arthur Goldberg. And Mr. Goldberg was tough. You know, he was a tough guy to work for. And he had eliminated the position of a lot of Hilton executives.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, he retained me, and now he was asking me to stay, and I just wasn't comfortable doing that. And then I called Lorenzo Fertitta and said, okay, now I'm ready to talk.
Yeah.
And then within days, I signed a deal with him.
You're right.
But ironically, though, Blake Sartini was the president and CEO of the company.
Right.
You know, Frank Lorenzo were whatever they were, chairman or whatever else. But Blake, who I knew, we worked together as young men at the Barbary Coast.
Right.
So Blake, I was going to be working with Blake and for Blake. And my family and I went to Europe. I took a month off, left the Hilton, took a month off, and then I was going to start at Station Casinos. When I came back, I called Blake's office, and the secretary says, Blake's no longer with the company. I couldn't believe
it.
I was shocked. Yeah.
After
that one? Yeah. But Steve Cavallaro, who you might know.
That's a good one,
yeah. Yeah, he was the president, and he was also an old friend.
Sure.
And it worked out well.
Well, you had to develop, what did they have at that time, 9 or 10 properties?
Oof. If I remember right, I think it was 8.
Yeah.
And
okay.
It was literally right before 9/11.
Right.
When I started.
Okay.
Weeks before 9/11. And, you know, I was just getting my feet wet, just getting to meet some of the hotel general managers and so forth, watching the news one morning, watching my wife on the news that morning as the planes crashed into the World Trade Center. And, you know, changed the industry, changed our country. Yeah. Yeah, everything changed at that time.
Right, right. So, but, you know, you got to develop Red Rock Resort, you know, and expand the sports books at all the other casinos. And, you know, they're still massively successful for the Station Casino Company.
Yeah, they are. It was a real honor to be part of it. I thought when I went there that they would benefit from my experience, right, and my knowledge, but I didn't realize how much I would learn from the company. And
yeah,
the company is,
yeah,
extremely smartly managed.
Sure, no question. And you know, there's still some great people there. Scott Krieger is now in Steve's position. You know, another,
yeah,
good guy. You know, so they just have the way of making their employees feel like family.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you have some stories in the book about that. We won't go into them right now,
no,
but how they took care of you. So it was really, really touching, for sure. Mm-hmm. So then, while you're at Stations, the PASPA regulation is overturned, and PASPA is a Professional and Amateur Sports Betting Act, which was passed in the early 90s, which outlawed sports betting in all the states except for Nevada. It was declared unconstitutional in 2018 by the U.S. Supreme Court, and immediately New Jersey, which had already passed a legalization of sports betting, they opened their sports books, and it opened the floodgates. But you played a little role in that. Explain what,
yeah,
role you played.
Yeah, when we were at the Hilton, after the Las Vegas Hilton Superbook opened in 86, a couple years later, we opened a sports book at the Flamingo, Las Vegas, on the corner of Flamingo and the Strip. And we linked that sports book to the Las Vegas Hilton.
Mm-hmm.
It was linked by computer data line. And it was way easier than we anticipated.
Right.
We thought it was going to be challenging. It wasn't. The systems were put in by Vic Salerno, my longtime friend. The odds boards were integrated, the betting pools were integrated, and it was just a seamless opening, and it was the first such interface of its kind in the industry, and then we came to the realization that if we can do it there at the Flamingo, we could do it elsewhere. And we had a great CFO at the time, Bob Kaczynski, who you might, mm-hmm, you might remember. You know, sharp guy, very forward thinking, and a good friend. And I wish I could take credit for this, but it was really Bob's idea that why don't we go to racetracks and put in sports books at racetracks across the country. And so we, you know, went to the legal team and had an analysis done of the Interstate Wire Act and the Interstate Horse Racing Act, and we thought we could. We may be able to navigate legally through that legislation, and so we started going out to racetracks. Myself and Roxy Roxborough, a longtime friend,
sure,
brilliant sportsbook consultant. Roxy and I went to a lot of racetracks around the country, and presented this proposition. And some racetracks were lukewarm. Some were very negative. Churchill Downs, in particular, was extremely,
yeah,
negative, as they were towards everything.
Right,
it was competitive, but Laurel Racetrack in right outside of Washington D.C. Really liked that,
right,
concept, and they just grabbed onto it right away. And in retrospect, that was the worst thing that could have happened.
Yeah,
because it, all of a sudden, Congress got involved.
Yeah,
and before you knew it, before we could get any further, Laurel actually started building a sports book. They were that,
yeah,
into the concept. But the next thing you knew, PASPA was the Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act was proposed and became law, the law of the land,
right,
almost overnight.
Sponsored by Bill Bradley.
Yeah, yeah.
A New Jersey senator at the time.
Yeah,
right?
He was. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he was very vocal opponent,
right,
to sports gambling.
You know, probably if you found a track in Nebraska or something, it wouldn't have been such a big news. But because,
right,
it was right outside of Washington D.C., that's probably why.
Yeah, and then that put the brakes on everything we were talking about,
right,
and it stayed that way, and until PASPA was repealed in 2018.
Right. Okay. So It seemed like almost an instant, but over the past 5 or 6 years, now there's almost 40 states and territories and jurisdictions, U.S. jurisdictions, that offer sports betting. And it happened really quickly. Why do you think it happened so quickly?
Well, I'm disappointed that it happened that quickly. Yeah. I really am. I mean, for all those years, I was hoping that PASPA would be repealed. And I thought that it would be repealed if it ever reached the Supreme Court.
Right.
And sure enough, that's exactly what happened. But the way some states have jumped into the business, and they don't have a lot of expertise. They don't have any expertise in regulatory oversight of sports gambling. Even some of the operators in a lot of states don't have experience in sportsbook operations. And I've been disappointed at what I've seen. You have to, looking at it from my perspective, being vilified by the leagues and certain components of the media for so long, and then all of a sudden, when PASPA was repealed, everybody wants in, and they jump in with both feet overnight. Now, it's been too fast, and there's mistakes being made, and the integrity of the game is a real concern of mine now.
Sure.
Those things have to be addressed now. They can't ignore the issue, and the partnerships and the sponsorship deals that between the gaming companies and the leagues themselves are sending a very, very mixed message that can't stand.
Sure.
It can't stand forever.
Well, you just authored an op-ed in the Las Vegas Review-Journal last weekend, as a matter of fact, the front page of their opinion section, arguing that point. Why do you think that has worked out that way?
I didn't see it coming.
Yeah.
You know, when PASPA was repealed, I thought that the states would inevitably emulate the Nevada model of sports gambling.
Right.
And that hasn't happened. They've emulated European and Australian bookmakers, and even bringing in European and Australian systems and bookmakers and operating MOs are foreign. They're not U.S.-based. So I've been very surprised about that.
Right. Well, of course, in Europe, the soccer teams always had sports betting advertising on their sweaters or jerseys or whatever they call them over there. And now we're starting to see it. I know the Washington Capitals a few years ago had a sports book on their jersey, and I know the Golden Knights here in Vegas do as well.
Right. So, yeah, absolutely.
So, do you think that really damages the integrity of the sports when you see sports books advertising and sponsoring and making money off of these teams?
Well, what I don't like is the teams and the leagues telling the players and the staff how evil gambling is.
Right.
Stay away from gambling. And then they're signing official sponsorship deals with the same teams that they're telling their employees how bad they are.
Right.
I can't stand. And if you look around, Roger, look at Europe. Look at Italy, where sports gambling has been legal for how long? 5 years, maybe, or something. And, sports gambling is legal. Sports gambling advertising is not. It's not that extreme in some of the other countries, the Netherlands, Germany, the UK and Ireland, for sure.
Yeah.
They were the leaders in the industry as far as sponsorship was concerned. But now they're all going the other way. There's pushback everywhere except the U.S. The U.S. keeps plowing forward in the direction of commingling the two industries, but the rest of the world is not doing that.
Sure, no question about it. So you were a consultant with the NBA for a while after sports betting was legalized, correct? And that kind of left a bad taste in your mouth too, as well.
I was a consultant for the NBA for a decade, and it was another fun, valuable experience for me, but I didn't think that they got it then, and I talk about that in the book too. I didn't think that they put enough emphasis on preventing the kind of problems that are now running rampant.
Right.
And if they don't come together now, once they lose their credibility, once their integrity is compromised, and the public becomes convinced that the integrity is not there any longer, then it's going to be very, very hard to get it back.
So I saw a story just recently that last year sports betting won 12% of the money bet on them. I recall when in Nevada, you guys used to be happy with a 5% profit, correct?
Well, not me. my books always did better than the state. Every year.
But the state always was around 5%.
Yeah, the state was always around 5%, but I was always quite a bit higher. Yeah. And the reason being that I always pushed parlays.
Sure.
And I pushed the parlay business. And the rewards programs and comps and everything were geared towards the parlay players. And I always had a tremendous business with parlay players and took high limits on parlays and, you know, it inevitably held really high. So what I tell people today, everybody asks me, you know, what's your best advice for sports gamblers? My first advice is don't bet parlays.
Yeah.
Bet straight
right.
bets.
Exactly.
You know, so, I mean, that's the only shot you have. Any successful long-term sports gambler is a straight bettor, nothing else.
So a lot of the states that have legalized sports betting and kind of did so in a rational manner with reasonable tax rates are now raising their tax rates pretty immensely. I know New Jersey just went from 15 to 21%, and now a state like Illinois just added a 50-cent fee for every sports bet made. And, of course, the sports books are passing it on to the bettors, and Michigan's considering that now, too. I mean, are they kind of killing the golden goose?
I think they are.
Yeah.
But they should – those states should have recognized early on that sportsbook industry, the sportsbook business, is not as profitable as everybody thought. Yeah, it's popular. People love it. They love to engage in it. It's a great draw to the properties in some cases, or a great opportunity to sign people to your mobile app and the rewards club and so forth. But the sportsbooks themselves are very expensive to operate. The whole percentage is much lower than most casino games, and it's not the revenue-producing area that people thought it should be. I always looked at sportsbooks. Now my sportsbooks were always successful you know, for a long time, but I always looked at I had a couple of priorities. Besides protecting the company's license being my number one criteria, number two, providing great customer service was number two. But third, I looked at it as the entertainment center of the property. And the sports books that I was involved in building and operating always were open to the casino, and TVs were around the casino. So you wanted that excitement from the sports book going all through the casino. I see some properties today where their sports books are really isolated and away from the crowd and away from the table games and slot machines, and that's missing the mark, in my opinion, especially out of state. Outside of Nevada, you see that a lot.
Okay. So the latest challenge of sportsbooks now is something called predictions markets. And if anybody's seen, you know, watch any sporting event lately, you'll see ads from a company called Kalshi, Polymarket, Coinbase. These are all financial companies that are calling their bets trades. So you're trading a financial instrument, which puts them under the auspices of a federal agency, CFTC, I forget what the acronym is for, but they can skirt state laws that way. The states that don't allow legal gambling, or the states like Nevada that do allow legal gambling, these companies can operate there without a license and without paying taxes. I mean, how big a threat is this to the sports betting business and gaming as a whole?
Well, it's a big threat in Nevada, you know. I share the concerns of the industry in Nevada and the Gaming Control Board in Nevada, where you know, companies and individuals have invested so much time and energy and money into building these properties, and then to have somebody come in and operate right over top of them with no license. Of course, that's going to upset the industry and the Gaming Control Board. Somebody came to me with this concept about 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. And they laid it out, explained everything, showed me all the pertinent laws, had a white paper written and analyzed and with legal opinions. And I digested it and came back and I said, it's never going to happen. It's never going to work. Well, I couldn't have been more wrong. They have taken root. Now, whether or not they're going to have staying power, we don't know. Mm-hmm. But I did not think that this could possibly happen, and it has.
Well, I did a podcast with Joe Asher. Joe is another longtime sports book guy. He ran William Hill for a long time, and he recently opened Boomer Sports Book here in Nevada, which is a great way to bet here in Nevada. But Joe says this is a concept that's been around for a long time. It's just called a betting exchange, which is what it used to be. They operate that in Europe as well. A company called Bet365 operates in New Jersey. I know that. Also a betting exchange, which is basically players betting against players, and the money moves between the players, and the prediction market or betting exchange takes a cut of it. Was he right about that?
He's mostly right about that. And I looked at exchanges at Betfair and BetDAT out of Ireland.
Sure. Yep.
I looked at those companies early on also, and I was intrigued by the concept too. But these prediction markets today that were taking bets on political races and social events and so forth, I never saw that coming. I didn't I argued for the right to book elections in Nevada for a long time, to no avail.
That's what they can do as well.
And Joe, by the way, I say that Joe and Governor Christie in New Jersey were the two people most responsible for repealing past month.
Well, I'd like to defend Christie, but there's actually a senator from North Jersey, a state senator, that pushed that bill until Christie couldn't push it away anymore.
What was his name?
I'm forgetting his name, Ralph something.
I can't think of it.
You remember, Howard? I don't remember it. But
it'll come to me.
He pushed it for a long time, and finally Christie got on board. But I give him credit. He should be in the Hall of Fame, not Christie.
I think he is.
Yeah, exactly. So, I really enjoyed your book. I mean, every page I turned, I knew somebody's name, but the stories were fantastic, too. And you tell some really, really great stories about your family and really touching and emotional stories. And I don't really want to go there because I'll get emotional, you'll get emotional. But you tell a story about your brother. He was kind of, I guess, the black sheep of the family for a while there. And tell that story, if you will, without going too emotional on me.
Okay. Well, Jimmy, he was 14 years older than me, so there was quite a gap. And he was off to the Army, when I was little. But when he came back, he tried a few odd jobs here and there. But once he started working for Uncle Jack and then got into the bookmaking world, he was hooked too. And he became quite good at it quite fast. And I love Jimmy. He was far different personalities. He was a fighter and a brawler and a flamboyant personality. He always drove the best cars and the best watches and the best clothes and so on and so forth. Much more so than I ever did. But he loved his family very, very much. He took care of his family. He took care of me. And I miss him.
Yeah.
He did die tragically in a boating accident in 1991. Just prior to that, his bookmaking caused me a lot of difficulties in getting licensed in Nevada. And I do chronicle that story in the book. And, before that, I was pretty naive about how that could come back to bite me because I would never did any business with him. I didn't work for him with him. I never did anything improper in Nevada. And Jimmy, on the other hand, he could care less. if anybody told, I remember telling him once that gaming regulators were going to talk to him, and he told, well, I can't repeat what he said. he didn't care. He did his own thing no matter what.
So that's going to be it for tonight. Thanks for joining us. This was supposed to be a book signing, but I screwed up and didn't get the books here. But the book is available on all your favorite Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, wherever you buy your books.
HarperCollins.
There you go. So
the one thing we didn't mention is how thrilled I am to be not only to be talking to you tonight, Roger, but to have this here in Boulder City, which we love Boulder City. It's
absolutely
the greatest town in Nevada and one of the greatest small towns in America. And if I ever talked about moving away, I would do it as a single person, I'm sure. We love Boulder City.
We love Boulder City for sure. So thanks for joining us. And those of us So those who joined us on video, thank you for joining us very much. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on the Gaming Legacy Podcast. To buy a copy of the bookie, visit your favorite bookseller or go to harpercollins.com. Art Mantaris is contributing the profits from the bookie to the charities Blood Cancer United and the World Wildlife Fund. Special thanks to Grant Turner and the staff at Skinny Bar in Boulder City, Nevada for hosting this podcast and to our videographer, Billy Walker Media. To learn more about the topics discussed on this episode, visit ggbmagazine.com. So we'll see you next time on the Gaming Legacy Podcast.